Hello and welcome to another edition, a new edition of the Flag Hunters Golf Podcast. I am your host, Jesse Perryman, and along with Justin Tang, this week we proudly bring you a man by the name of Marcus Westerberg. Marcus, notably, is the author of the book called The Golfer's Sixth Sense. And that title alone should give you some deep insight to what this conversation is about. I got a lot out of it. Marcus, give you a quick brief intro about Marcus. He grew up in Sweden. He played on various golf professional tours for the better part of 15 years, earning 8+ victories out there. So the man can play. He understands what it's like to be in the trenches when it counts and when it matters and when everything is alive when you're playing competitive golf, especially for a living. So this conversation really is about getting into the mind and what we can learn on the golf course, off the golf course, what we can learn about ourselves and apply that valuable information to our games moving forward to help us become better. And this man really represents what Justin and I are trying to accomplish here with a holistic style of not only teaching, also learning. And we believe that the paradigm needs to be shifted as far as how golf is taught and just as important how we learn this game, because once you start learning, once you start growing, once you start getting better, there's just nothing like it. And a big shout out to Marcus Westerberg. You can find Marcus find him at Instagram, Marcus Westerberg, his name. You can go to www.marcuswesterberg, and that spelling is MarcusWesterberg.com. All one word, MarcusWesterberg.com. I highly encourage you to get a copy of the book, The Golfer's Sixth Sense. It is fantastic. I highly recommend that you read it, learn it, absorb it, incorporate it, and it will undoubtedly help your game. And I want to give a special shout out to our sponsors, TaylorMade and Adidas. That new TaylorMade head is pretty damn good. The Q10, go out and pick yourself up one, get fitted for it. You're undoubtedly going to love the feel of it, the sound, everything. TaylorMade really did a great job with this. And kudos to them, and a big shout out to them for sponsoring Justin and the show. And please, always forget this. Please remember to rate, review, and subscribe. Have a great week, everyone. Cheers. Hello and welcome to another edition of the Flag Hunters Golf Podcast. I am your host, Jesse Perryman, along with my co-host, teacher extraordinaire, one of the great minds in golf, that I consider, and I know a lot of coaches out there in the world, and his name is Justin Tang, and he's also a good friend. And along with Justin and myself, we're proud to introduce to you a man by the name of Marcus Westerberg. His background is very interesting. He went out and played for a living, and now he is an executive coach, a performance coach, and he has written a book called Golfer's Sixth Sense. Is that right, Marcus? The Golfer's Sixth Sense? And we're going to dive right in. But Marcus, once again, welcome and thank you for coming on. And we look forward to this conversation.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I really look forward to it as well.
Thanks, Jesse. Thanks, Marcus. Mm-hmm. It's a real pleasure to have you on because your book really captured my imagination. And as I told you before, it's probably in the top 5 of all the golfing books that I've read. And not just golfing books, right? I would place it in the top 5 of learning textbooks, because your book is not just applicable to the golf swing, but to other endeavors and other sports as well. So
thank you so much. I'm really honored to hear those words from you.
Truth, man. So let's just give our listeners a little bit background of how you came into golf.
Yeah, so actually I was thinking about it today. I'm playing my 47th year as a golfer. I started out very young. I'm turning 50 this year. And I mean, as long as I can remember, I dreamt of becoming a golf professional to tour the world. And I did. I toured a lot of the world, played on more of a second level, played a few on the main tours. But I mean, coming into this and being a professional golfer, I like to say that every golfer is naked in front of the golf ball, in that sense that you're going to be exposed to who you are in every sense of the word. And that's what I find so fascinating and wonderful about our game, which really is the game of life. It's life in miniature. And as a professional golfer, of course, you have to take responsibility for every shot you play. And you get faced with yourself. And I was faced with myself. And there was a lot of things that I did not like and a lot of things that I did not understand. So after my career, I took into studying. I got a bachelor's degree in psychology, focusing on performance and motor learning. And also, I've worked with my mentor since I was 23 years old and just putting that mirror in front of myself, learning who I am and why I function the way I do. And it's a tough journey, but it's invaluable. And as a coach, I like to say that I want to be the mirror to my players to help them see themselves, because I don't regard myself as being able to change them. I can only help them see themselves so they can change their own games and improve.
And that's the thing with the term golf professional. It's very limiting, in my humble opinion. I like to think of our job as being that of a coach, where we help our players, our students, our clients draw out what's already in there. Mm-hmm. And it's not just golf swing, as we alluded to in our conversation before recording. Every instructor is familiar with golf talk. Neutral grip, Vardin grip, baseball grip, steep plane, shallow plane. But not many golf instructors are familiar with terms that the learning industry, if you will, are familiar with. Things like spacing, constraints, positive, negative constraints, variability, short-term, long-term memory. And I feel that if coaches understand how the brain acquires new motion, retains it, and then ultimately repeats it under pressure, our clients will be that much better for it.
Yeah, I agree. And that's a dear topic of mine, because a lot of clients come see me. You're an expert on the mental side, and can you help my son or myself to improve or whatever? And I just cannot put that firewall between how you learn, how you practice, and how you perform. You cannot separate these two, because like you said, it's basically all about learning and retention. And this is where a lot of golfers and even golf coaches get mixed up, that performance in practice does not equal learning. And learning is defined as what you can use after a period of time. Have I learned this swing change? Have I learned this kind of ball flight or the shot or whatever I'm trying to do? And for me, this is imperative, because it's so easy to stand on the driving range and just beat ball off the mat to the same target, if you even have a target, with the same club, and just it feels really good and you may even hit good shots. But how much have you improved? You have certainly improved more than if you hadn't practiced, but if you'd practiced in a different manner, and this is what I researched a lot for the golfer's sixth sense, is this retention of learning, is how should you practice to come more prepared to the tournament or whenever you want to perform. And then, of course, we come into a lot of the constraints versus some training aids that make it easier for you. And when we talk about these things, I always want to come back to an example that I like to use when I talk, and it's what I call the 100 putts. So let's say you're a golfer who wants to improve your short putting from, let's say, 4 feet. You're going to hit 100 putts. Now, you can do this in two different ways. You can stand on the same spot to the same hole and repeat the same putt 100 times. Or you can move around and hit a new putt every time, but still 100 times. So I always ask my audience when I do this. So the first question, which is going to have you make more putts? Is it standing in the same spot or is it moving around? And everybody is like, well, of course, standing in the same putt, playing the same putt is easier. I'm going to make more putts from there. Okay, good. The second one is, which is going to make you a better putter, moving around or standing in the same spot? The answers from the audience tends to go towards changing the variability, but it's not always certain. But let's say it's a 60-40 there. But then the third question is the most interesting. And this comes from research about judgment of learning, which is basically after the session, you ask yourself, how much have I improved? How much have I learned? And it can also be attributed to confidence. So I always ask, which way of practicing leaves you with a better feeling, with a better judgment of learning? And everybody says, of course, well, it's A, it's the one when you stand in the same spot and hit the same putt. Now, this is a little, in a nutshell, what it's all about, because it feels better to practice in this, what is called the blocked way of repeating everything, because you perform better. But everyone, all the research says that, well, that's not the best way to learn. So the guy who moves around and hits a new putt every time improves more, but it feels worse, which is very interesting. It's something you have to be aware of in practice. And it doesn't only apply to putting. It applies to every part of motor learning.
Indeed. With that in mind, I always tell my students and my members, I said, the way you guys are practicing, it is as though you're practicing for a 7-iron tournament. You get a bucket of balls after 100 balls. All you do is try to hit 7 irons straight. I said, tell me the last time on the golf course where you had to hit 2 7-irons from the same spot. They said, oh, I can't remember. I said, I'll tell you. You hit 2 7-irons from the same spot when you shank the first 7 irons out of bounds. That's when you hit 2 7-irons from the same spot in a row. I said, that's anything but golf. And Jesse and I always talk about the ego orientation to your point. It feels great. Everyone's looking at me. I'm the club champion. I'm sinking 100 putts in a row from the same spot. Does something for the ego, but does it help you improve as a golfer? So back to the question, are you playing golf swing or golf? The game of golf is inherently difficult, but the golf swing need not be that case. Because if you understand simple ball flight laws, then it's not difficult for the educated instructor to affect your ball flight. How you look while affecting the ball flight is going to be different from Billy. It's going to be different from Tommy. You need to settle down, look in the mirror and say, hey, I'm born with longer arms or shorter arms, as the case may be. I'll never look like Tommy or Billy. Once you put that to rest, I think the pathway to improvement suddenly clears up.
Yeah. And that's a perfect example, the 7-iron tournaments, because that's what we see. We see maybe a few wedges, the 7-iron, and some drives on the driving range, probably without the target and off a mat. And it's not really preparing you to play on the golf course. And then I get the question, why can't I take my game to the golf course? Well, you're not really preparing to play on the golf course. So that's number one. And people don't like to hear that. But I mean, it's kind of given. And when it comes to all these things, I always go back to my favorite philosopher, Socrates, and his quote of know thyself. There's so much about knowing yourself and the game of golf that is helpful. Knowing your game, what you can, what you cannot do, what you're good at, what you're bad at, what you should avoid. Knowing yourself, how you react in certain circumstances, etc. And this is just another one about knowing how your practice habits can influence your performance on the golf course.
So what was the catalyst that created a change in your teaching? What made you realize that the traditional model is broken?
I think I realized it quite early as a player, because I'm a sports person. I can do a lot of sports, so my hand-eye coordination is pretty good. And I was put into a model occasionally by some coaches, and I didn't like that. I felt constrained, and I felt like I couldn't really reach my potential. And I know I can do this, but in another way. So I think that's when I really early started to question this. And I think I was in high school already doing this. And then I've always been observant. So I looked around and see how other people are doing it. And I just look at the best players through the times, and only for looking at their golf swings and just taking that approach. I mean, they're so different, similar in some parts, but they have found their way of getting that white little ball to oblige to their wish. And I had a lesson with a client of mine yesterday, and he said that, well, you can't really get anywhere unless you're as well your own teacher. And I think that was a great way of putting it. I was reflecting on that. It's like, yeah, I I am coaching him, but he realizes his own responsibility in the process that he needs as well to be his own teacher and observation and reflections.
So a lot of people say that the conscious mind is the head, but what they do not realize is that the subconscious is the neck that turns the head. So with that in mind, what made you write the book, the fabulous book, The Golfer's Sixth Sense?
That's just why I wrote it. So the reason I wrote it is that I saw this clear division between mechanical practice and mental training. And I couldn't grasp it. I mean, there is great mental training programs and you can do excellent sessions in pure mechanics, but you cannot separate the two. They go together all the time. And I think the perfect example is someone who comes and says, well, I always feel uncomfortable. I'm afraid on the fourth tee. Well, of course you are. It's a dog leg left and there's OB right and you only have a slice in your bag. I mean, you should be afraid. You cannot change the mental side because it's not a mental problem. It's a swing problem or a ball flight problem. And then you can get it the other way around, which is more normal. But I like to make the example of touch or feeling, putting or chipping. Is it mechanical or is it mental? Well, I'd say it's both. And when you look at the game of golf, it's a lot of the times both. And that's why I love coaching, because it's a piece of mental, it's a piece of mechanical, and putting that together. So the reason I wrote The Golfer's Sixth Sense, I didn't like the separation. And of course, the reason you can't separate the two is the subconscious mind is always there, always controlling, and it's overriding your conscious mind all the time. And as it happens, the Golfer's Sixth Sense is your subconscious mind.
So let's talk a little bit about swing changes. A lot of people are a bit double standards when it comes to changing their swing for good. So they realize that changing my swing for the good is difficult. And then they don't realize that it also takes a good swing time to deteriorate. So that's maybe a better player's mistake. No, better player's misconception. So from your experience, how long does it take for a bad swing to become good, and conversely, a good swing to become bad?
The first question is easier. I mean, learning a good golf swing, well, that takes a lot of time because there are so many components and they're just a journey of learning. Again, you're knowing yourself, you're knowing your swing. When the ball does this, I do that, and I need to do X. And the deterioration of the golf swing, well, I find it happens two ways. Either it's a physical deterioration that, of course, if you get less flexibility, you're going to have a smaller arc of movement and all this, and probably some more impact difficulties. But I've seen a lot of, especially good players, go down into what I call the mechanical trap, where they try to dissect the swing and perfect it. And it kind of takes them away from their natural ability. So timing is affected. Just getting that club face to the ball consequently. And how long does it take? Oof, I don't know. I've seen scary examples of it with really good players. What's your opinion on the latter one?
I think it has to do with the stories you tell yourself. And that, it's your thoughts lead to words, your words lead to deeds. So if you kind of open yourself to the possibility that, hey, my swing's not perfect, we've seen that down through the years with guys who've just won majors. If you open yourself up to that belief, then guess what? You're going to start taking actions that will start changing, or as I call it, taking apart the iPhone. You start to take apart the iPhone because you believe that the speed of the processor is not right, battery life is not right. And if you manage to fix that, power to you. But what I've seen over the years is that a lot of people take apart their phones, then they can't put it back. And it seems to me that the process of deterioration is almost on par as that of improvement. So for example, let's call a 24 handicapper. It takes them about a year, give or take, to get down to 18. And I think it probably takes the same amount of time for a scratch golfer to get to 5 handicap, about a year, give or take. And depending on how drastic the overhaul is. But what I'm trying to say is this: if you think something is wrong, something will go wrong. Because if you can execute at the range flawlessly, as we see on tour ranges across the world, across the tours, and then you can't execute it on the course when it matters, it's not your swing. It's not the technique. It's what you tell yourself before you execute the technique. So with that in mind, I'd like to ask you to explain to our audience, what's the difference between the brain and the mind, and what is the psychomotor connection?
Yeah, so I like to make the difference between the brain and the mind, because the brain is kind of the physiological matter, and the mind is all the interesting stuff with emotions and thoughts and feelings and memories and all that. And it takes us directly into the psyche. And the psyche, of course, we talked about the subconscious and the conscious parts of the psyche. And the psychomotor connection, I like to describe that as the interplay between the motor skill, the swing movement, and all the other stuff, the memories, the thoughts, the emotions, and all this stuff. It's a constant interplay. The emotions can affect the golf swing. The golf swing is going to affect your emotions. As we know, hitting a perfect shot is going to make us feel really good, and vice versa. And I think that psychomotor connection basically describes why I wrote The Golfer's Sixth Sense, because, again, we need to take into consideration both these parts, and you can improve your golf swing through mental exercises, and you can improve your mental through golf swing exercises, like improving some kind of shot you want to play is going to make you feel more confident, because you know you can do it. So that's another on the psychomotor connection, connecting your swing motions to you, how you feel, and all that thoughts that goes on in our minds all the time.
So with that in mind, when a golfer slices the ball into the woods and he says to himself, "You brainless idiot," that's inaccurate. It should be, "You mindless idiot," because everyone has a brain. Else you won't be alive.
Correct. Yeah.
So let's get down to the meat and bones of your book. What is the fundamental paradox and what causes it?
Yeah, this is... I'm not a favorite of quick fixes and mind hacks and all this stuff that is so much broadcasted everywhere. But when we come into the fundamental paradox and the lifting reflex, it's actually one that you can use and improve your game really quickly. So the fundamental paradox, I've observed it around the world as a player, and then I observed it as a coach, and I see it all the time. And it's about the impact. And the human mind, 99.9% of golfers have this problem. When the ball is on the flat surface, they try to lift it, with a lifting swing motion, because the paradox is that the club should be traveling slightly downwards in order to hit the face of the club. The face of the club is tilted upwards, and that is what gives the golf ball a lift. Our minds do not understand this. We think that we need to get the motion of the club from underneath and upwards to get the ball airborne. So in all sense, the paradox, the contradiction is that you need to hit down to get the ball to go up. And I like to tell all my audiences that I'm sure you have this problem. I'm not sure how much it affects you, probably a lot. And when you have to play the golf ball over a bunker or over a water hazard, it's going to be worse, because your mind knows that the path to the green along the ground is blocked. And of course, this is a completely subconscious problem, because I've had a lot of clients who know this. They know everything about how the club should impact the ball. It should be ball, then turf. However, their subconscious overrides this knowledge. So they need effective tools to counteract what comes out of the fundamental paradox. The fundamental paradox is a faulty picture of the impact. And what comes out, this is a lifting reflex. It's a lifting golf swing. And it results in duffing and topping. And it's completely detrimental to a lot of golfers' games. So you need tools to handle this, because your mind is probably never going to learn that you have loft on the club. So you need to have tools for it. And one, the easiest way to do it is just brush the grass after the golf ball. Make some practice strokes, brush that grass and set up to the golf ball, and again, do the same. You need to do it, and especially if you need to play over something, because your mind's going to want you to lift the ball over the bunker, but you can't. Only your golf club can. It's your responsibility as a golfer to hit the ball on the face of the club. The club is responsible for getting that ball airborne.
Yeah, that's quite unlike many other sports like billiards, tennis, baseball, where the mass of the implement generally follows the intended direction of the ball flight. Golf is different. If I want to get the ball up in the air, the mass of your implement needs to go down into the ground.
Yeah, that is so interesting. And I'm lucky enough to grow up in Sweden and live in Sweden, and we play a lot of ice hockey, and the exact same problem exists in the slap shot in ice hockey. All the young kids, and even if you don't start as a kid, they're trying to lift the puck off the ice. You can't. You need to put pressure on the stick into the ice, and the stick is going to lift the puck. And it's so interesting. It's completely subconscious again. And it tells us, just when we started this conversation, about who is the master, the subconscious or the conscious mind. And the conscious mind doesn't have a chance here, because the subconscious has made its mind up, and then you're going to follow. So you need to know how to handle that.
So this is something I discuss a lot with Jesse. I've got this theory, hypothesis, that a lot of good players get good because their eyes, when they see a golf swing for the first time, the eyes interprets the movement correctly, so that when he generates that intention to do something with the golf club, it is correct. Whereas 99% of the golfing population, when they see a golf swing, they go, okay, this is what I should do to make this motion. And they take the club, they go, okay, backswing. And they actually swing it behind them, resulting in too flat a golf swing. And the reverse will be true. They go, oh, okay, this is an upswing. And they just literally lift their hands with no pivot rotation. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you've studied in the past?
How we see I've certainly observed it. I've certainly observed it. And I mean, there's a lot of talk these days that the talent doesn't exist. I would say the talent definitely exists, but it doesn't take you all the way. Some have it easier than others. Why? I don't know. Are they born with it? Probably partly. Sports experience, other sports is helpful for golf. But then again, I've seen some tremendous top 10 players in the world today who has only played golf. So it's an interesting question. It's very interesting to philosophize about. But if we go back to the fundamental paradox, the faulty picture of the impact, I have seen one player in 47 years of golf who has not had it. Every other player has learned to handle it. And tour players I've talked about who's read The Golfer's Sixth Sense and connected with me, they're like, it really helped me too. I mean, they're PGA Tour players, which is, I mean, they can feel that they have that inclination. But why do some people swing the golf club more efficiently than others immediately?
Hard one to answer.
Interesting.
It's very interesting. Yeah, it's something that I wish I was smart enough to investigate, but clearly I'm not written any books yet.
Yeah, but it's a great topic for a discussion.
Yeah, so basically this goes back to meta awareness, something that Jesse and I talk a lot about. Some guys are just aware of things in general. And as you mentioned, right, golf is such a great metaphor for life. I see some students, the way they drive their buggies, the way they hit their balls, repair their divots or not, you kind of have a very good idea of what they are like in the workplace. So guys with no golf etiquette, generally, I would imagine them to be lacking in social awareness. Oh, I didn't realize I shouldn't do this or that. And how important is meta-awareness in acquiring or modifying our movement patterns?
Well, I think it's definitely important. And just awareness overall is just, some pick up the details. Some are able to see which are important details, and some just miss it completely. So I think this is very important. And like the examples you just gave, it's, I think the personality comes into play here quite a lot, which we can see on the golf course. Again, everyone is naked in front of the golf ball. It's hard to hide who you are because it's important.
I'd like to chime in on the subject a little bit on what Justin and I talk about, what you just raised, Marcus, about meta-awareness. I think that there are a lot of great players out there who are extraordinarily aware of what they do with their hands, of what they do with their body. Tiger was, I mean, I remember hearing a story about Jack Nicklaus rerouting the golf club with the famous one iron in the 72 open at Pebble on 17. That's next level awareness to do that in that environment, in that situation. You know, the real question is, how do we cultivate that? How do we cultivate an awareness so that we can look at things as they are without any preconceptions, without any ego attachments? I would say Jim Furyk's a pretty aware guy. I would say he's very, very, very aware guy, meta-aware. He's able to look at things as they are and not through a skewed lens. You know, the real question is, how do we develop that? How do we develop that level of awareness so that we can look at our games objectively as it is in order to make necessary changes, whether it's physical or mental or in preparation, how you manage yourself on the golf course, especially day to day, because our body's not the same every day. We might wake up stiff. We may wake up not feeling that great. We may not have the extra gear for that day. So how do we cultivate that meta-awareness apart from the ego to be able to just do things and accept what we can do on that particular day?
Yeah, I like that objectivity focus to see things as they are. And I think it ties back again to my favorite quote from Socrates, know thyself, know where you tend to go wrong and try to stay objectively, observe the golf ball with less judgment and really take in what's happened here. Because I like to throw those questions back to my students. Okay, that was a terrible shot. I went out to the right. Okay, why did it go to the right? I swung like that. No, back up again. Well, club face was directed to the right. Okay, good. Now, why was the club face directed to the right, etc.? So kind of breaking it down on the objective level, less emotional, even though paying attention to your emotions and feelings is quite valuable. But being present in the moment, I think, is a requirement to be able to go into to heightened awareness and looking at things, like you said already, objectively. And that gives you a chance to learn as opposed to trying to find an answer as quickly as possible to soothe the ego, not to feel hurt or attached to the lesser shot, or even it's a good shot, because you can learn from that too, and the ego can definitely get in the way of that understanding as well. So being present and being objective, I think, is quite valuable in any endeavor, especially golf.
So let's talk a little bit about the practice pitfall. So there is an ongoing argument about block practice versus random practice. And I share with my listeners as well as my students, I said, both are equally valid depending on what your objectives are. So could you share with our listeners when they should use block, when they should use random practice techniques?
I think blocked practice is excellent when you're discovering differences between swing motions or clubs or breaking putts or whatever, just trying to discover and see, okay, that's what happens. That's a good way to use block practice. Also good to get a feeling for what you want to do. But I like to use it as soon as my players are able to perform the movement, always want to raise the bar, because I like the gym analogy. You don't go into the gym and take weights off and hope to get stronger. You put weights on to get stronger. You want to make practice more difficult in order to improve. So block practice is easier. and using some kind of training sticks or alignments or all that makes it even easier. And it's great in an initial stage, but you have to take it from there because, of course, the golf course is different. But not only because of that, because of, again, the research and motor learning shows that the retention, meaning how much you learn from the practice. Let's say you're trying to change your swing plane to make it very simple. If you keep changing it around, it will change your swing plane faster. It's kind of counterintuitive, but the research is conclusive. But I am not anyone to say that block practice is all bad. I say there's a time and place for it, and there's a progression towards more complexion, more random practice, changing targets if you're in the driving range, changing shot shapes, changing clubs, and all that. But also remember that the random practice, it's more tiring on your mind, which is, again, a sign of that we have put weights on and improvements. So, but I know that many fall away from the random practice because it's more difficult and because they don't perform as well. So I always want to put up that flag of caution about confidence. If you're practicing to improve your confidence, you may give yourself a disservice because you are falling into block practice, simplified practice to improve performance. When you practice, you should focus on improving learning, improving yourself, getting better, not performing better. It's a great piece of knowledge for golfers of any level.
So are you a fan of training aids with that in mind?
Yes and no. There's a time and place for everything. I'm not a fan of crutches, meaning that you use training aids, especially on the putting green, because putting is such a versatile part of the game. When the ball is played in the air, it's more or less the same if you're in South Africa or in the US or in Singapore. But greens are so different, and you need to be able to adapt to all of it. And I'm not a fan of having someone standing in the same spot and wearing out the green for 2 hours, sitting the same putt with lines and eights and all that stuff. I think it constrains your mind away from what you need to do to be able to adapt to all of the different situations in putting. And we must always remember that a part of playing a golf shot is not only the movement. It's also taking in and let's say reading the green or reading the situation, choosing the shot, choosing the club, paying attention to the lie, and also the post-processing is an important part of a golf shot. So that's what you also get when you do a randomized practice. When you do block, you already know everything, especially on the green. You've hit that putt before. And I do not like my players to do that because when you have post-putt information, you are learning to use a piece of information that does not exist in the game of golf. You will never, ever on the golf course have post-putt information. So I don't like my players to get used to that. I like them to always train their minds into gathering information, reading the green beforehand, and then just observing what has happened afterwards. Not compensating to it because you never get a second chance in putting.
Yeah, Jesse and I have this discussion. I explained to Jesse that every putt, every shot is basically us guessing how much force to put in the shaft, what kind of shot shape, where do we land the ball. Everyone's a guess. But if you are just using a training aid or a setup that establishes paths, how hard to swing, then are you really working on your guesstimator, if there's such a term? You're not learning how to guess and estimate because you put your brain into this frame of mind. Look, this is the putt, 12-footer, downhill, 1%. This is the feel. And you never learn anything outside of that. And I've heard very intelligent guys in the learning community tell me after 1 to 4 such repetitions, the brain switches off because there is nothing novel. So no learning takes place.
Yeah, I can imagine. And what worse is that makes me ask my players not to do it is again, that they get used to this post-putt information and they get probably overconfident, but they also start to use cues that doesn't exist.
So can you talk a little bit about the illusion of consistency and talk a little bit about the Nikolai Bernstein experiment or study?
Yeah, Nikolai Bernstein, Russian scientist who looked at the motor learning and consistency is a great thing in golf because we all want consistency. We all strive for consistency. We should strive for consistency all the while knowing that we can never be consistent. And I always look at the world number one, and there's usually a discrepancy of between 15 and 20 shots between his or her best and worst round over the year when they were world number one. So golf is a very inconsistent game by nature. As we can see, the scores fluctuate from round between rounds in a tournament. It can be a huge difference. And when you look at all the kind of research and I'm not sure which study with Bernstein you mean,
but the Hammer one.
So the Hammer one.
The stroboscope on it, and then for every swing of the hammer, the hand path is always different, slightly mm-hmm, different, mm-hmm. but still different nonetheless.
Yeah, there's a variation in everything, and as research shows us, it's a variation in the nervous system even. And but still we're able to bring the hammer down on the nail, even though we think we do it the same way, we do it slightly differently, which is quite interesting. And again, it's the subconscious mind that makes this adaption so that we can deliver the hammer or the golf club consistently well within the human lens.
Yeah, and a lot of us are not cognizant of this, but the subconscious mind is really so beautiful, so powerful. Just take a look at Jim Furyk's swing. It is quote unquote suboptimal, but I would say this, a lot of PGA Tour pros with more symmetrical looking swings would gladly trade their swings in for Jim Furyk's career.
I'm one of them.
Yeah, so it's us giving the subconscious an instruction and then kind of just trusting the subconscious to do its thing. But the caveat is this, the instruction or the intentional cue to the golfer or to yourself must be accurate. As you say, know thyself.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And that's interesting how to reach the subconscious. If you give an instruction, you're always instructing the conscious mind of the student in front of you. If you set up a situation and ask him to solve this with a certain ball flight, like let's say you should hit this shot underneath a tree branch, it's a great way to affect the mechanics of the golf swing. And when we're looking at what we talked about earlier, the lifting reflex, when you see the club golfer in the trees having to chip out, now the picture of the ball flight has changed. The subconscious mind isn't trying to get the ball high, it's trying to get the ball low, which improves their impact and unfortunately has them hit the ball in the face of the club that goes straight up into the trees. So they have the wrong club. But it's really interesting on as a coach combining the conscious knowledge, conscious information in the right way, not to mess it up with the subconscious intention that always will be there. And the subconscious mind knows everything. I don't even know what my subconscious mind knows about me. But I need to adhere to that. I need to listen. I mean, I try to do this move in the golf swing so many times, or that move, and it's just, I can't do it. So my subconscious mind is telling me, your left hip is a little bad. You cannot swing like that. You have to swing like this. So it's this constant combination of listening to, observing, of course, the student in our case. What is the student's subconscious mind telling us? And what do we try to do? Are we even able to do this thing we want to do with their golf games or not?
I think
another illusion.
Yeah, let me chime in here, Justin. How do we marry the subconscious with the conscious mind as it relates to golf? How can we bring what are directives from the subconscious mind into awareness to actually reprogram it to do what we want it to do, what our intentions are? Because if the subconscious is the boss, ultimately, how can we make it work for us consciously?
Mm, that is the great question. And I think awareness is one key. so that, again, you don't try to do things that you will never be able to do. So you have to listen to yourself. Listen to what your body tells you, your mind. Sometimes, though, it may be wrong. And this comes back into the emotional intelligence, reading the signals you get from your mind or your body. I mean, there are lots of, let's make it simple example. Just like I spoke about the lifting reflex, playing that pitch shot over the bunker. To marry the conscious mind, the subconscious mind there is to not let that faulty preconception take over by focusing on brushing the grass with your golf club, brushing the grass with your sandwich, instead of trying to play the shot over the bunker. Because you know, again, you know yourself that the lifting reflex is going to take over and your impact will be worsened. So that way you need to consciously focusing on brushing the grass to not let the subconscious take over in that case. In that case, you're changing your intention with the shot. Instead of playing a ball over the bunker, you're swinging to brush the grass. So that's one way of doing it. When it comes to a lot of other stuff in golf, I like the exaggerations. A slicer always try to hit the ball straight. It doesn't help. You have to try to hook the ball to get it straight. And golf tour professionals know this. They can come in from a golf round and do an interview and say, I hit the ball perfectly straight, all 18 holes, and you hit 18 greens. It was just perfect game. And they go, yeah, I was trying to slice it. And the interviewer doesn't know what's going on. Well, they had a little bit of a too much draw problem in their swing. So they had to contradict that by trying to fade it consciously. And the median result is a straight shot. So it all ties back to know yourself and be aware. Be aware of what's going on and what you are doing.
Great answer.
Another illusion that a lot of golfers can't seem to come to terms with is this powerful effort versus effortless power. What are your thoughts on it? And then do you have any drills for our listeners to do?
Yeah, when I think about effortless power, I think about an efficient mechanics of the golf swing that goes back to the basis of movement, which is the sequence of movements. Every club member admires the juniors when they stand or hit golf balls. And the reason most of them have an efficient sequence, as we know, we're starting the downswing with our hips instead of starting it with our arms and hands, which is a forceful swing, but less efficient and less powerful. And starting it with our hips and getting into that kinematic chain is going to give more power. I like the wall drill, where you set up with the wall down the line behind you. If I was watching you in the driving range hitting balls straight behind you down the line, let's put a wall there. And the wall should be so close that you can't make a normal backswing. But you take the club to the top and then start with practice swings. You make a swing and you brush the mat or the grass without hitting the wall. Now, the only way to not hit the wall is to create the lag angle. And your mind is smart enough to know how to create the lag angle, and this engages your lower body. And basically the lag angle in the golf swing is stored power, and that stored power comes from an efficient downswing sequence. So I have seen a lot of success with the wall drill. I would suggest that. But when we're talking about these movement patterns and coordinations, it's very interesting. And also when you work in coordination, starting the downswing with your hips instead of what you're used to starting the downswing with your arms, it's going to feel awkward. And then again, the feeling of awkward does not signal that this is a bad thing. It signals that it's a new thing. And again, know yourself, is this better or is it worse? So I find the wall drill interesting. I've only discovered it lately, and I think it's quite efficient.
So any last thoughts on swing thoughts versus swing feels before we pull the trigger? So when I talk about swing thoughts, it's usually this. I see a student takes 5 seconds before he hits the shot. And I say, hey, are you giving yourself a golf lesson before a shot? Oh, yes. I say, when you do that, it's okay. Just don't have the word, keep the left arm straight, flashing in the background of your mind. I said, feel it. Feel what does keeping the left arm straight feels like.
Yeah,
so that's interesting. Are there pros and cons versus
I'm not sure. I mean, research says that some people are more visual and some more kinesthetic and some like feels and some like other instructions. But whenever you see a golfer freeze over the golf ball, you know there's a checklist in his or her head. And that checklist is not getting shorter. It's a sign of over control, and it's definitely not improving their performance. It makes them extremely tired. So I like to use exercises like empty the bucket with those who have a long checklist. And empty the bucket is hitting balls completely free without any swing thoughts. And it takes time, and you have to force them. I'm telling them that as soon as you put the club behind the ball, you have to start the backswing. And they don't like it. They hate it because it feels like they're losing all control, but actually they're gaining control because that checklist is appealing to your conscious mind, but it's destructive to your subconscious mind. And again, the subconscious mind controls your movements, and golf is a movement game. It's not chess. It's not solving crosswords. It's not an intellectual challenge. It's a motor challenge. So the checklist is a sign that someone is trying to over control it. And if you do have that, if you freeze over the golf ball thinking about your grip, your left arm, your start of the backswing, your transition, your tempo, and don't do this, don't do that, you want to empty the bucket.
I think if Bruce Lee played golf, he would be a really good golfer. To gain control, you have to lose control. Be like water.
Mm-hmm.
So in closing, where can our listeners find out more about you, your book, and your services?
You find my website at marcuswesterberg.com, and you find me on Instagram, Marcus Westerberg Golf, and Facebook, The Golfer's Sixth Sense. I also have a YouTube channel, which is the same, Golfer's Sixth Sense. And I'm mostly active on Instagram, and that's where you can see some daily content from me.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and I'll make sure to put all that information in the show notes as well. All of that information on how to get a hold of Marcus and Justin.
And our sponsors.
That's right. That's right. I'm good. I'm so thrilled with this conversation. As we've mentioned before and in past episodes, I really do think that this discussion really is the next level. I can see it on the sunrise in a paradigm shift in golf instruction, where you know we're able to come from a place of neutrality and really observe what it is that we want to work on and to be very clear with what it is that we want to do with our games, to be very clear with our intentions, and I don't think we're ever going to get rid of the ego, but we can certainly repurpose it, we can redirect it, and I think that's where we're heading. And thanks to you, Marcus, for being a pioneer in this space and continue to enlighten all of us to play better. Because that's at the end of the day, I speak for a lot of golfers, especially better ones, that we all want that deep satisfaction of playing well. We all want the deep fulfillment of realizing what it is that we've worked on tirelessly and having it manifest on the golf course, and have that deep level of satisfaction. And this is certainly a conversation that needs to be spoken again and again and again in order to achieve that. So thanks to you, and thank you for your
contribution.
Thanks
so much. Thanks. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you, Marcus, for your time. Really appreciate it.